supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The New York Times called Carlo Malanti's book Matterhorn a raw, brilliant account of war. A highly decorated Vietnam veteran, Malanti's novel captures the terror of war, but also beautifully describes the human experience under human circumstances. Here, he describes a group of Marines getting ready to leave for battle. The kids filed quietly to the edge of the strip to wait for the helicopters. Other Marines stopped to watch them, wanting to say an encouraging word, yet not daring to break into their private world, a world no longer shared with ordinary people. Some of them were experiencing the last hour of that brief mystery called life. Carl Marlantes joins us today to discuss Matterhorn and his own experiences during and following the Vietnam War. Carl, thanks so much for joining us. Do we have you?
I'm here.
Hi. So let's start at the beginning. You graduated high school in Oregon. It was 1963.
That's right.
And at the time you said you'd never heard of Vietnam. So you signed up for the Marines, went to Yale, and you went to officers training school during the summer. So far, so good. When did you realize that things in Vietnam were raging and you could be in danger?
I remember it very clearly. It was in March 1965, and the New York Times got delivered to our room. And there on the front page was a headline that said, Marines land in Da Nang. And I went, where is that? And that was the beginning of understanding that what I'd done a couple of years ago might get really serious.
What was your reaction? That initial reaction?
It was, let's see if I can remember. It's that sort of combination of dread and excitement. It's like, oh, wow, this looks like we could be going to war. I may not just be guarding embassies, and that's scary. On the other hand, it's like, oh, wow, this is what it's all about. And that's exciting.
Well, that's what it was all about. So let's come back to your background. You said it was pretty natural for kids in your logging town to sign up. You said the young men, by and large, felt they owed time to the service. You too?
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. I mean, you have to remember that almost all of our fathers were World War II veterans. And back in those days, the draft was universal, and you sort of felt like, well, you know, it wasn't like a great day if you got drafted, but there was never any thought that, well, you would resist it or you would, you know, head across the border to Canada. It would be like, well, I'll do my duty. And a lot of us, since we already said, well, you're going to get drafted anyway, might as well join up and get it over with, or, you know, some people wanted to make a career out of it. For me, it was just do it. And I think that the telling word in the language was, it was always referred to as the service. You know, oh, it was when your dad was in the service, or that was when he was in the service. Service, and that's a different connotation.
That's interesting. So you graduated Yale. You won a Rhodes Scholarship. And
right. The
Marines were happy to let you delay your entrance to active duty. And certainly by then, Vietnam was getting out of control. It was pretty obvious that it was
getting
out of control, and you must have assumed that you'd wind up there. So you went to England to study, but tell us what happened after that.
Well, like I said, yes, you're right. It was amazing. I didn't think the Marines would do it. They just assigned me to England and said, it's a great honor, take it. And they were terribly short of junior officers at the time. So when I got over there, I began to feel, I guess the word is guilty. Some of the guys that I'd gone through training with were over there fighting. people I knew had already been killed. And I just felt like I was hiding behind privilege. And so I was faced at that point in my life with a fairly serious decision, which was desertion, because I was in the Marine Corps Reserve. And if I decided I wouldn't go fight in the war, well, then I'd have to take off to Sweden, or Algeria was the other choice, but not quite as amenable as Sweden. And or go to the war. I just couldn't feel like I could just hide behind the privilege, which was offered to me of sitting it out for a few years. So I decided to go. I didn't want to not ever be able to come back home or see my family again.
Was desertion a serious consideration for you?
It was serious, because by that time it was quite clear that there were a lot of questions about the war. And I think McNamara decided in 65 or 66 that it was not winnable. Of course, we didn't know that. And it was a serious consideration. I really did wrestle with that, and chose what I chose.
I'm sure you've been asked this before. You've got a powerful story. You're extraordinarily eloquent, and you chose to tell the story through a novel and not an autobiography. Why?
I think there's two reasons. The first is that I had this experience when I was in my mid-30s, and I've told this before. It's that reading Eudora Welty's Delta Wedding, there was a scene in there about shepherdess crooks not coming in time for the wedding, and I went, well, that's a trivial thing. I mean, who cares? But by the time I got done with the book and I had entered into the character of the woman who was responsible for the wedding, my whole view about what was important in life and what was important about her life had changed. I could only do that because I got into her skin. So I realized that if I want to try and explain or tell people about my experience, the best way to do it is to get someone to sort of enter into the skin of characters and see the world through a character's eyes. That's literature, and that's different than, autobiography.
Well,
the second reason was that I wanted to imagine what was going on in other parts of the world and other parts of the military at the same time that the characters were experiencing many of the things that I experienced. And I couldn't do that without being fictional.
I also wonder if there's another factor, and I'm going to go back to what I read of your book. And that last line about those kids, those Marines, you said some were experiencing the last hour of that brief mystery called life, which really, really addresses the power of your experience. And I wonder if perhaps you wanted to keep some of that power at arm's length for yourself, for your own welfare.
Well, that's interesting.
I hope you were forewarned that I'm a psychologist.
I wasn't. But anyway, don't listen. I think that you're on to something again about writing the book itself was difficult. I mean, I get nightmares. I get back into scenes. And it's an interesting question whether the fiction actually distanced me from my own experience or not.
One of the themes in the book, in your life, in your experience over there is, how the brain protects itself best it can.
Yes.
And this may be another example. And I don't want to minimize all your other rationale. I mean, that's certainly
no, clear. I think that there is something about that. I mean, even in the novel itself, there's a lot of black humor. And the sole purpose of that humor was trying to, keep your mind intact by I think distancing you from experiencing at the moment the unbelievable amount of intensity emotions that are going on. You step back and there are stock phrases like "there it is" that help you through the experience. Mm.
I want to start talking about this amazing book. The main character in the novel is Lieutenant Mellis. He's he said that a president would not lie to Americans.
Right.
You said you believed that too.
That's right.
I'm guessing that shifted while you were in Vietnam.
Oh, along with the whole rest of the country, I think it's. I remember getting into an argument at Yale with other kids there, and saying out loud, "Well, the American president wouldn't lie to Americans." I mean, that stuck in my mind, and it's one of the reasons that it's in that scene in the book. They all started laughing. Now, I was from a small town in Oregon, and I went, "Whoa!" And when I tell that story to my kids, they start laughing too. I think that Vietnam was a huge watershed between naivete, which is not healthy, but I'm worried that we've now shifted to cynicism, which is not healthy. I mean, but there's no doubt I changed as the country did.
You changed in that way. I wonder if it changed your sense of service or indebtedness to your country when you felt betrayed.
Yeah, you know. You do ask hard questions.
Sorry.
That's
the only way I can keep my job here.
Yeah, right. You know, I think not. I think that what I felt was a lot of anger at being misused. Now, being misused does not mean that you shouldn't still be used in a positive way by your government. I mean, we all join together in a body politic, and I think that we owe a certain amount to making sure it functions. When the leaders of the country and the decision makers, the movers and shakers, misuse that gift or that offer, that's what's wrong, not the fact that you offer something to your country.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back and talk about the main character here, Melis. Like you, he came from a logging town. He went to an upscale school in the East. Tell us about his first few days in Vietnam.
Well, it was one of the difficult things about writing the book in terms of our artistry is that the first few days that anybody lands into a combat zone, it is sheer confusion, overwhelming information. I landed, you know, myself like that, and so did almost any second lieutenant that's ever come in there. You're faced with, you have training, and Melis had training, but when he got there, it still wasn't adequate, couldn't be adequate, and he's suddenly faced with people whose names he can't remember. He's in a part of the world that he's never been in before. He's in a climate that he's never experienced before, and clearly, leading people in combat is something that scares him and terrifies him. Will he do a good job? Will he get killed himself or maimed? And all of those things hit somebody that first few days. It's a very disorienting period.
When our executive producer, Mike and Scott, spoke to you last week, she asked you about the similarities between you and Melis, and you said that Melis was a far better politician than you. What do you mean? And you know, now I'll ask the naive question: why? Where do politics come in combat?
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, it's an organization: the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps. It's an organization, and when I'm speaking of political ability, I'm speaking of the ability of people to move ahead, to manage well, deal with people well in large organizations, learning the ways that things get done that aren't necessarily the way they get done by the book, but the way they get done in actuality. And all of these skills are what I call political skills. And Melis has them, and I don't. It's just not my nature. But I know people who do, and they use them positively or negatively.
One of the themes in Vietnam and in your book is really about trust. I mean, you and I are just about exactly the same age. And what it looked like to me when I read the news is that you guys didn't know who were friends and who were foes, who was really North, which who of the South where you could trust and who you couldn't. So trust was a major issue, but there was issues of trust with your fellow soldiers also. So who did you trust in the early days?
It devolves down to you trust the people who you know. It became quite clear that at some level, who knows what, you know, the State Department, the President, people that are far, far beyond anything you can, you know, approach, are saying, and is it believable or not? What you start to learn is that there are certain people who you know who, if they say, I'll get there at, you know, 9 and your life depends on it, you know that they'll get there at 9 or they'll die trying. Those are the people that you trust. Beyond that, it got to the point where you didn't, and you were suspicious.
Well, you know, speaking of trust, there were race issues, too. In addition to war with another country, this country was also at war with itself on many, many fronts. And one of them is the Black Power movement, which comes right on the heels of, you know, the uproar around civil rights in this.
Yes.
In this country. So Malice had to deal with that issue right from the first day. Tell us what happened there and how that story unfolded.
Well, in the novel, there is another character who is actually parallels in every way the skills and the ambitions of Malice, and that's a character named China. And he is an idealist, and he has passionately adopted the code of ethics and the morals of the Black Panther movement and also the Black Muslim movement, Malcolm X in those days. And he is trying to change the way that the blacks and even the whites in the company think about race. But the way he's approaching it is by trying to supply weapons to the movement back in the States, because it's very easy in combat to get parts, because you say you need them, or to find weapons that are, you know, people die, you can just break them down, send them home. And he's sort of like the ombudsman of the blacks. And Melis is thrown into a situation which existed in actuality at the time, which was that the country was going crazy. I mean, you remember, I mean, there were riots in Watts and Detroit and snipers killing firemen in Newark, and it was unbelievable, the tension and the fear. And you take a bunch of 19-year-old kids and arm them and put them together in a situation like this, we're talking about unbelievable racial tension. The military in Vietnam had to handle it, and it wasn't easy. There were ugly moments.
And Melis was China's superior.
That's correct.
And Melis and you certainly had no training in managing these kinds of things.
Well, that's right. I think that all this stuff was dealt with, I mean, in the actual history, by very young people having to work it out themselves. And to the credit of all those people, officers enlisted, that was when I believe racial integration really started happening. And it goes back to trust. It was like, oh, I can trust this person. This person has my back, and he's a different color than I am. That was not common until that experience happened in the 60s.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I will take some calls, and I want to know how that story with China and Melis unfolded over the course of the book.
Okay.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Cora Morlantis, who's written I don't know if it's a bestseller yet, but it's a critically acclaimed book about novel about Vietnam. It's called Matterhorn, and it's just gotten wonderful reviews, and it's a great book. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about the impact of war. So give us a call to share your experience if you're a vet, or especially a vet from Vietnam, or you've got a family member who's a vet. We'd love to hear from you. That's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Delaware Theater Company supports WHYY and presents Anthony Lawton's The Fousey, April 28th through May 16th. A terrorizing witch meets her match in a Russian village in this comedic tale of good against evil, told by people and puppets. In the spirit of the Brothers Grimm, with equal parts Monty Python and Tim Burton, The Fousey is a theatrical experience for adults and young people alike. For tickets, 302-594-1100 or DelawareTheater.org.
Spring is in the air, and some of the year's most anticipated albums are starting to bloom. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kotz. And this week on Sound Opinions, we're going to review new albums from MGMT, LCD Sound System, High on Fire, and more.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Cora Morlantes, who has written Matterhorn, about a novel about the experience in Vietnam. Where'd that title come from?
Well, Matterhorn is the name of a hill that the Marines are asked to climb and then put an artillery battery on top of. They were called fire support bases. And that, the name was just a code name. And in the novel, I just happened to have the generals decide they were going to name them after Swiss mountains. But there's a old bluegrass tune that I mention in the book, and it's called Matterhorn, and one of the lines is, men have tried and men have died to climb the Matterhorn. And it's a central image for me, of the war, which is that we did it to ourselves. The Marines in the novel build the thing, fortify it, are ordered to abandon it, and in some confusion, leave their fortifications intact. They're occupied by the enemy. They are then asked to reassault it at great cost, and then they're asked to abandon it. And so the reason it's the title of the book is because it's a central metaphor for me of the war itself.
Did anything like that happen when you were over there?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's it happened to me several times, assaulting hills at great cost, and then sometimes as soon as 2 or 3 days later, moving on and just leaving it. It's so difficult psychologically to see that much given, to gain some ground, and then just be asked to leave it. And it's all over the history of Vietnam. Hamburger Hill is the 101st Airborne publicized event like that. And it goes back to that strategy of all we're here to do is to kill as many North Vietnamese as we can. Attrition. But the trouble with attrition is that it's a game of who's going to last out long enough. And if it's not your country, you're not going to last as long as the people defending it.
Yeah, and that's probably why the numbers were so high.
Yeah.
You said you used the phrase when you went up and down the hill. You know, you took it and gave it up. I think the phrase you used was difficult psychologically. Difficult.
Yeah.
Difficult. I mean, well, let's come back to the book. You know, I'm just hung up on that word. It seems so low-level emotion.
Yeah.
You know, it's so clean. So in the book, Melis became close with his superior.
Mm-hmm.
That was Lieutenant Hawk.
Hawk, yes.
And there was a point at which you, or Melis, was ready to kill his superior. And in the book, not just angry enough to kill, but actually close to assassinating this man.
Yes.
So tell us those circumstances, and what was the message in the book? What were you telling us?
Well, there is no doubt that when these things were asked, that at the time I was enraged. I think that's the stronger word you're using, but you're looking for. But I'm going like I'm on the radio. I got to sort of tone this down a bit. No, there's no doubt that there were times when I would even say murderously enraged.
Right.
But I never fell over the line, which is to actually act on it. Some people did act on it. There were numerous murders in Vietnam. They were called fraggings. I think over 200, where someone throws a hand grenade at a superior officer or non-commissioned officer and murders them from that kind of rage. I think that it was there. And so in the novel, I try very hard to just lead the reader through the experience and get to that same point themselves and then have it all abandoned. And in the novel, it's a novel. I have the central character go over the edge, beyond where his reason no longer controls him, and he's rescued from that mistake by Hawk, who is a central figure, almost like you're the psychologist, almost like a superego for Mellis.
Yeah, tell us about Hawk and his relationship with Mellis.
Well, Hawk is the character that Mellis has to aspire to. When Mellis first gets there, Mellis is just ambitious. I mean, when he loses a squad leader to a rather serious event with a leech, his only concern is replacing him. Not whether the compassionate response, which is like, this guy is hurting. I mean, are you okay? And this Hawk, who's the company executive officer, who's been there quite a bit longer, is sort of, Gawain to Mellis's Parsifal. He's the one who knows the code, knows how to achieve it. And Mellis has to sort of eventually get to the same point that Hawk is. And that's, of course, his character arc. He does change. By the end of the book, when this particular Marine comes back, he asks him, are you okay? And that's a very important line, because that's when we understand that Mellis has finally achieved what Hawk represents.
Tell us how Mellis feels about Hawk. Is he a mentor? Is he a father figure?
Well, let's see. The relationship would be mentor. I'm quite sure that is what it is. I think that any time a young second lieutenant goes into a situation that is overwhelming, you look for somebody that doesn't look overwhelmed, that can help you through things. And, of course, in the relationship between Mellis and Hawk is that. Mellis desperately wants to have Hawk like him. He wants Hawk to think he's a good person, all of those things. Now, I don't know if that's a father image or a big brother image, but it is certainly that close. And I don't know if mentors, do in fact fall into the same kinds of roles psychologically.
Sure they do. And what was your experience over there?
Well, I had there were a couple of people that I really felt and admired and thought I want to try and get like them. One was a Marine officer who was a colonel miles removed from us in terms of rank, who would show up on the lines in the middle of the night. And I described that briefly with Colonel Mulvaney, who takes on that role in the novel. And I never knew this person, but from afar you could say, now that's the kind of guy I want to be. And there was an Army general named Stilwell who came out on Christmas Day and landed on a helicopter. We had no idea what was going on. Now steps a three-star general, and people went, wow, looks like he does care about us. And then there was in my own company an executive officer of just a few months older than I was, but who had been there for 6 or 8 months already, that was a great leader. You just, everybody wanted to be behind him, wanted to do what he wanted them to do, and it was like, I want to be like him if I can achieve that. And I was very fortunate to have him as he was a company executive officer.
Was there that closeness? You're talking about role models, where you look at someone from a distance and say, I want to be like that. But was there anyone you felt that kind of closeness with, kinship, that you kind of trusted to mentor you?
Oh, yes. But that would be right at the company level. And here's one of the problems with maybe all wars, but certainly that war in particular, is that the mentors end up being your own age. You do not have any relationship with older people. The only people out in the bush are 22, 23 years old. There would occasionally be a non-commissioned officer who would be like 27, 28 at the oldest. So you have nobody who's older. All you have is people who are more experienced. And it's kind of like, you know, I don't know what you say, it's the kids leading the kids. But some of these kids rise up to the level where you say, wow, that guy knows how it's done and where it's at, and I admire him. But it's hard when there's nobody older around, and the kids have to fumble through it themselves.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Karim Marlantis, and his novel is called Matterhorn. It's, as the New York Times says, a raw, brilliant account of war. It's about the experience of Vietnam, 40 years in the writing, and we'll talk about that later. If you want to join the conversation, it's 888-477-9499. We're talking about the impact of war. So if you are a vet, especially if you were in Vietnam, or if you are a family member of a vet, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones, and we've got Frank on the line. Hey, Frank. Frank? I hear him in the background, but I don't quite hear him. You know what? Let's take a station break. Maybe we can pick up Frank on the other end. Like I said, we're talking with Karim Marlantis, and our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Please Touch Museum at Memorial Hall in Fairmount Park supports WHYY and presents Exploring Trees Inside and Out, now through May 2nd. At this exhibit, children can climb up high into a canopy and slide down into a bed of leaves while they experience nature's sounds, smells, and textures. Please Touch Museum is a place for children to learn and play with their families. Located just off I-76, the museum features on-site parking. For information, 215-581-3181 or online at pleasetouchmuseum.org.
It wasn't her high school reunion, a big date, or even New Year's Day that inspired Bertice Berry to lose weight. It was Barack Obama's inauguration.
And I was sitting there crying. My daughter was like, yeah, I know you're happy because a black man's finally president. And I'm like, no, I'm crying because this is my last bowl of popcorn with M&Ms in it.
Bertice Berry's story of her year two wellness, we'll talk about it next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with Karim Marlantis today, who's written a novel called Matterhorn, which is an extraordinary novel. We're talking about the impact of war, and specifically Vietnam. Karim, we've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation, and I'm certainly not done with you either. So we have a lot to do in 20 minutes. Frank didn't pick up the phone because I was calling him by the wrong name. Let's go try to get him again. His name is Mike. Mike,
hello.
Hi, Mike. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. Perfectly okay. I think you've kind of touched on it a little bit. I had joined the Navy in 75, the all-volunteer force there, and I was stationed in Guantanamo, and I used to train with the Marines because we didn't have enough people to guard the fence line. Anyway, the one thing I had noticed, and it kind of rung true to me, was how young the kids were. I mean, we're talking kids sometimes 17, but 18, 19, and these kids were, well, they were kids, you know, and it was probably Vietnam would have been one of the few wars where they were that young, because when you ever see a movie, you know, you see John Wayne or somebody much older playing the part. But the actual age of the people, that was something that struck me. Although we were in peacetime, I could only imagine how difficult it could have been for some of these young kids who came out men, like you said earlier.
Well, Carl, you know, you talk about fear. You compared it to an electrical charge when you were over there. Tell us about that fear. How it impacts you physically and emotionally, and did you guys ever talk about your fear over there?
Yeah, the reason that I use the image of an electrical charge is because it's that if you've ever seen an electrical transformer or something where an enormous amount of current is going through it, it's actually vibrating, and when your body is hit with adrenaline, it trembles. And it shakes, and you try very hard to keep it under control. And at the time, you wouldn't talk much about afraid you were, because you sort of knew that everybody was scared, and it was sort of like, well, you know, if I start to talk about it, then that's gonna maybe make it less likely that other people are going to be able to hold on to their own psyches. And so it's sort of almost like a mutual agreement that we know this is happening to us, but let's not get it out in the open, because for heaven's sakes, I don't want to lose whatever control I've got. And you know, later on, I think I experienced that loss of control. I mean, I'd be telling somebody, you know, in a psychological session about getting ready to go up the hill, and I would break down bawling with, you know, snot coming out of my nose and the whole thing. Well, that's the last thing that you want to have happen if you're about to go into an assault, especially if you're responsible, you know, for leading the troops.
So I hear about fear management through my psychotherapist's ears, and I also know, you know, while the fighting was raging in Vietnam, I had just started my career, and I was treating substance abusers.
Mm.
So I was getting vets over here who were addicted to all sorts of drugs, but especially opiates seemed to be, you know, in addition to marijuana, opiates seemed to be, you know, a drug of choice over there. So I wonder if that was, you know, another way of coping with the fear, the terror.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the novel deals a lot with drunkenness. There were two ways at that point in our history of basically going unconscious while you're still awake, and that is to get blind drunk on alcohol or to get stoned out of your mind on marijuana. And that's what happened. I mean, when troops would come back from an operation, it was just accepted that they're going to just go into oblivion here. And the reason is because when you're back from an operation, you know that within 5 days, 7 days, not very long, you're going to be back out there, and it's very frightening. Hmm. You don't want to think about it. And, you know, and you're 19. I mean, the average age, I did it once. I was 22, 23 when I was there. I was the second oldest in the whole company. My company commander was 6 months older than I was. I think the average age of the company was like 18 and 10 months or something like that. They're kids. So what are they going to do when they come back and they're frightened to death? They're going to do whatever they can. And I think the problem is that behavior then just said, well, this helped me cope when I'm in the war, so when I come home, it'll help me cope. It's the wrong approach, bad strategy.
Sure.
But I think that's common.
Well, it's like you said, though, the terror over there doesn't get left over there when you come home. A colleague of mine once said, all buried emotions are buried alive.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is there. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jake on the line. Jake, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
It's Chick, by the way.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I really enjoy your show. this guy's been there, and he everything he says is really hits the nail on the head. Especially about the guys you trust and respected, you know, somebody that you could count on. And if somebody let you down, he was rebuked. Sometimes, like the guy said about fragging, a lot of that stuff went on, even in the rear, even with the guys who weren't in the jungle. You know what I mean? They just didn't put up with any nonsense. You had to do your job and cover your other people.
Your life was at stake.
I got a question for you. You know, Carl and I were just talking about buried emotions or buried alive. So what did you bring out of Vietnam? What was adjustment like for you?
I liked what he said about being misused. And that I didn't think our president would lie to us either. But it was a real letdown when that became true. You know, you always find out 10 years later what actually happened. And, you know, they get the president on film lying to us, you know.
That broke a lot of people's heart. Thanks so much for your call, and thanks so much for your service to the country. Take care. So, Carl, when you got back from Vietnam, and this is a question that is very uncomfortable for me to ask, because I was on the opposite end of the continuum from you. I hid behind school to stay out of the draft. I was a little younger than you, so that I was a year younger, and that makes a big difference. I knew what was happening over there at a younger age, and I didn't want to go, and I wanted to do whatever I could do to go. And on top of that, I was one of those protesters protesting against the war. So when you got back from Vietnam, you received anything but a hero's welcome. And I wonder what kind of impact that had on you. You went over there, you felt betrayed by your country, you felt betrayed by your superiors in Vietnam, and then you come home to this.
Yeah. It was, I mean, I sometimes think that the trauma of coming home to what you thought was sort of, you know, safe harbor, and then finding out it was hostile, I mean, really hostile, coming back. I mean, one friend of mine got off the plane at El Toro Marine Base, and he was going to hitchhike home to Santa Barbara, and cars went by him and stopped, and he said, "Wee, I'm on my way home," and the kids in the car threw beer cans at him with beer in them, and it was like he said, it just, he's never gotten over that. And myself, on lots of occasions, I mean, I would run into demonstrators that would be shouting obscenities at me and giving me the bird and waving North Vietnamese flags. I mean, right in Washington, D.C., where I was stationed. And I think the only feeling was just stunned. But when I look back, I realize that these kids, they're kids too, were caught up in some kind of a psychological issue of projecting all the stuff that they were protesting about, sort of warrior energy, onto people and saying, you know, you're the bad people, not us. And in fact, they're behaving psychologically almost the same way. It's like making someone else the enemy and not realizing that that's a person over there. I mean, I remember sitting there saying, you don't know who I am. I mean, you don't know me. I mean, I'm in this uniform, but you don't know me. And wanting to talk to them and wanting them to tell them that I am somebody like them, and that the people they're calling baby killers and all this stuff were younger than they were.
Well, Carl, I want to tell you, 40 years later, and you're right, I was a child. I didn't know, just like you were a child over there. But 40 years later, I feel great regret and great shame about my behavior when the troops returned. I don't think I did anything. It was it was just my sentiment. And, I still carry that shame. And in a way, I hope I always do. And I think a lot of people like me feel the same way. You know, we did learn our lesson as a nation.
Absolutely. I think that we did learn as a nation, and the generation that did it has learned. I mean, I was giving a reading in Berkeley, California, just last week, and I talked about being nervous. I was nervous. I didn't know what was going to hit in Berkeley. And it was full of people, mostly boomers, our generation, discussing what happened. What in the world happened that caused this nation to split the way it did and to scapegoat the other side? And I don't know, I've got time for a very poignant story. I was at a signing, a young woman came up to me, and she started crying. I thought, oh, man, you know, I can't handle this. She finally stopped crying. I said, what is it? She said her uncle was killed, her father's brother in Vietnam, and her father was a virulent anti-war protester. And they had a third brother who was a Marine. When the brother was killed, the two other brothers stopped talking to each other because one was a protester and then the other was a Marine. 40 years, they never talked to each other. She gave them each a copy of the book. And her father called his brother, and his brother also apologized to the father for not talking to each other for so long.
Wow. Wow. When you came back, you developed PTSD. Tell us about that, when you realized it and what happened since then.
Yes. First of all, just like I'd never heard of Vietnam when I was 18, I never heard of PTSD until the 1990s. I got into an extremely high adrenaline job, international consulting. I mean, time zone shifts, you know, massive crises, working, you know, 2 a.m, fed on the adrenaline. And I would do things with my family that were just crazy. I mean, my kids now, that's why I dedicated the novel to my kids who had the good and the bad of living with a combat veteran. I mean, I would take them up. I was on the Pakistani Indian border, you know, with the Indian troops, with my kids with me. And it was like no one's shooting at me, you know, and they were scared badly. And, you know, to me it was just normal. It was like, hey, this is fine. And then I finally got into a job in Singapore where I was running a corporation. And one day there's a board meeting, so I'm nervous. Also, Singapore is tropical, you know, everybody there is Asian. And I walked into the boardroom, and I saw a pile of dead bodies on the boardroom table. Now, I'm also fully aware that they're not there, but I was looking at them. It was the weirdest experience. I thought, something's going on here. And at that point, it got worse and worse, heart pounding, screaming, you know, people honking a horn at me in the intersection. I'd be out of the car, and literally one time I was on a hood, kicking in their windshield with my kids in the car. I had no idea. And finally got back to the States and went to a stress symposium. It was a bunch of psychologists basically ginning up business, and I was in a school cafeteria. I was telling him all these symptoms, and this guy looks at me and he says, "Were you ever in a war?" And I broke down bawling. I mean, a whole cafeteria full of people. I couldn't stop. 20 minutes, he finally gave me a card and said, "Go see the VA."
How is your mind today?
Well, I still have, I'm aware of what's going on now. I mean, like if I stand in front of an elevator door and it shuts, I used to get terrible sort of fear because that was the helicopter ramp opening and closing. But because of the help with a VA psychologist, it was like we understand what that is. So I just take deep breaths and I count, and I'm fine. They give me medicine. I have medicine that helps me with the PTSD. I have coping skills. I mean, things like, I don't watch war movies because I know that at night my wife won't sleep very well because I'll be thrashing around. So you learn how to deal with it. I've been told that it doesn't get cured, but you learn how to make it so it doesn't ruin your life. You don't end up doing alcohol and drugs to keep these feelings at bay. You end up dealing with them in a more healthy way, talking with a group of veterans, talking to a psychologist, whatever.
Carl, you spent 40 years working on this novel, numerous revisions, numerous rejections. Obviously, this was of critical importance to you. It's out now. Are you comfortable that your story has been told?
Well, yes, I feel...
What's that hesitation?
Yeah, the hesitation is this, is that it makes me extremely uncomfortable to suddenly be, talking to people on radio shows, I'm kind of an introvert. And so suddenly it's out there, and I had no idea it was going to hit, it was be so popular. I mean, it's been 4 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And I'm going like, that's surreal. It's almost like an identity crisis. And so that makes me uncomfortable. On the other hand, I feel a great deal of satisfaction that I stuck with it and I've gotten good critical acclaim. It's like, yes, you wrote a good novel, and I can put that aside. I don't think I'm ever going to touch another war novel. I know I'm not. Again, I'm done.
I feel like
it's a job done.
I hate to ask you this question with just like 1 minute left. How are you?
I feel very happy. I feel like I've come through a lot of stuff, and I'm quite solid. I've got a network of friends. I've got a VA psychologist that knows me better than probably anybody else on the planet, and I talk to her once a week. And I have a loving wife and 5 great kids, and so I feel very blessed.
Well, Carl, I want to thank you so much for the work you've done, for your wonderful book, and for taking time to join us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest today has been Carl Morlantis. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He's a Yale graduate, a Vietnam vet, multiply honored, and he's the author of a wonderful new novel called Matterhorn that I highly recommend. Next week, our guest on the show will be Dan Gottlieb. Mike and Scott's going to be interviewing me about my new book, The Wisdom of Sam. Well, if you've got a show idea or comment, we'd love to hear from you. We're at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. You'll find archived editions of the shows there, upcoming lectures, so on and so forth. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Thank you, Fred. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons and Stephanie Marudis. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.